You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Wisconsin farmer found his way into a new hobby after a back surgery left him with some free time. Now he hunts for unique and antique items related to dairy and farming history. We'll hear his story coming up. First, the state Senate reached a deal with the Assembly yesterday on what was supposed to be the last day of the legislative session this year. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald and Assembly Speaker Robin Voss ironed out three big sticking points: plans to close the state's youth prisons, tax cuts, and a school safety measure. All three were top election year priorities for Governor Walker. Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. Sean, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob.
Well, take us back all the way back to this weekend. We had this thing where the Assembly, they were done. They weren't going to come back, they said. There was a lot still on the table. The Senate was going to pass stuff, but that it wasn't going to match up. So we might have had nothing passed on some key issues, right?
Right. You had this standoff, and it looked like it could actually threaten the governor's election year agenda on a number of these high-profile bills. And headed into yesterday morning, that's where we were. And then magically it broke.
What happened?
What happened is that legislative leaders basically found a way to give a little bit on both sides and save face in the process. And, you know, they'd both kind of drawn a line in the sand, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, where Voss had said the Assembly, it's done with its regular session work for the year. Fitzgerald said, well, we're not going to come back in special session to take up the governor's school safety bills. And so what they did is they called this extraordinary session. And that is
a thing.
That is
That's a technical term. Title.
Yes, it's not not just extraordinary. That is what it is called. And that is an option that's available to legislative leaders. A governor can call a special session of the legislature. Legislative leaders can call an extraordinary session where they meet on a specific list of bills. And in this case, they decided that they would meet on a specific list of bills that had been changed or, you know, have now been changed slightly by the Wisconsin State Senate.
So the Senate passed these things yesterday. The Assembly takes them up. Let's break down the individual measures now that are extraordinarily under review now by the Assembly. So school safety, this is one that got a lot of attention. This is the most recently introduced one, right? This $100 million plan that we talked about last week. So what came through now the Senate on this?
Yeah, I mean the Senate, big picture, they kept the $100 million. So this this new Office of School Safety, which will dole out these grants and have $100 million to work with for schools that want to make physical safety improvements to their buildings, that is going to be there. It passed the Senate on a 28-4 vote last night, with four Democrats voting against and then a mix of all Republicans and most Democrats supporting it. That is headed to the Assembly, and it is on their extraordinary session agenda. So it looks like they're going to follow through on that.
And the Democrats who voted against it, and some of the ones who voted for it ultimately, they were raising a complaint that this didn't address any gun control measures.
It doesn't. They tried to add, I mean, they introduced an amendment to the bill that would have added a few provisions like universal background checks for firearm purchases and a ban on bump stocks like the one that was used in the Las Vegas shooting. Republicans used a procedural move to block that, so those were not added to the bill. But that was the complaint from Democrats, is that for a school safety session, there was nothing that restricted the purchase of firearms. Senate Republicans said they didn't want to go there because that wasn't going to get the support that this bill did get.
And so the Assembly, are they expected to vote for this as written now?
If it's on the agenda, they pretty much have to, or else it won't become law. I mean, anything that they're going to vote on now has to be identical to the senator. It's not going to happen.
Or the Senate would have to come back in an extraordinary session, I just learned about. So
I mean, they could,
it.
But I don't think that I don't think that's in the cards for them.
All right, that's school safety. Then Lincoln Hills, this plan to close the state's youth prisons, boys and girls prisons, and replace them with local ones. Where did that end up in the Senate now?
What ended up passing the Senate is very similar to what passed the Assembly unanimously. And so the Assembly plan would create a number of county-run institutions that are spread out around the state to handle less violent youth offenders that are in Lincoln Hills now. And it would create smaller state-run institutions to handle the more violent offenders, the more serious offenders at Lincoln Hills. And it would set aside money to pay for these things. The Senate was looking at a proposal that didn't do either of those things, didn't create these smaller institutions to replace Lincoln Hills, didn't set aside funding, but they backed away from that. They went with the assembly plan. The big change that they added is they said that the legislature's budget committee would have to sign off on plans for what replaces Lincoln Hills before the building starts.
So that is pretty close to a done deal now.
Really close, yeah. I mean, that's also on the agenda, and you can expect that passed the Senate unanimously, by the way. So that's going to pass the assembly as well.
And then tax cuts, a sales tax holiday, and then these $100 child tax credits. Those looked definitely in danger coming into this week. Where are we now on those?
What happened is that the Senate passed the identical version of the governor's child tax credit, which would be $100. Parents could get $100 for every child under 18. Those checks would be mailed out to parents around September. That passed. What they did was they scaled back the other provision of the governor's plan, which would create a sales tax holiday on the first weekend in August. And whereas the assembly's version of the sales tax holiday would have applied to, you know, almost any kind of purchases, the Senate's version would scale it back so that it just covered more limited list of stuff like school supplies and computer supplies, things like that. And so what that did is it brought down the overall price tag of that tax holiday from about $50 million for state government to about $12 million.
Now let's talk about that price tag. A lot of this was being done with some surplus the state government had, and some people have pointed out that surplus is a lot smaller now with that $100 million for school safety, with these tax credits, and the sales tax holiday.
Yeah, so we don't have an exact number on what all of these changes are going to mean for the state's bottom line, but if the Senate had passed everything that had passed the assembly, and this includes a lot of the governor's agenda for 2018, if they had signed off on all of that and sent it to the governor's desk, that would have reduced Wisconsin's general fund balance to in the neighborhood of $90 million. Now, that is a $17 billion annual budget, so that's not much money, not much cushion at all if the economy were to tick even slightly downward.
And one thing that didn't pass briefly, Sean, an incentive package for Kimberly Clark to try to get them to keep a couple factories open.
Yeah, this was something, it was like a Foxconn-style incentive package is the way that it's described, because it would give Kimberly Clark state tax credits for every job that they kept up at those plants. They're talking about cutting 600. If they kept all 600 jobs, they could get about $8 million a year from state government. The Senate pulled back on that yesterday. They said there just wasn't any indication that even if they passed it, that Kimberly Clark would necessarily stay, that they're still in talks, the company's still in talks with its union, and there's no guarantee that that tax bill would mean them staying in Northeast Wisconsin.
In 20 seconds or so, Sean, political impact here of passing those three big things we talked about.
I guess the big political impact is that the governor talked about these things. They were what he wanted to prioritize in the year of his election, and he got them. So it's not something where he has to go out on the campaign trail and qualify this stuff. It's looking like he'll be able to say he has these as part of his record.
Sean, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief, with us to talk about the bills that made it through the last day of the session in the state Senate. 3 years ago, after having back surgery, a Wisconsin dairy farmer was looking for something to do. With his computer and some eBay browsing, he discovered the wonder of collecting dairy memorabilia. Ed Larson is a former general manager of Larson Acres Dairy in Evansville. Now he's known for his collection of rare and antique dairy artifacts. Ed, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
In your career working on the family-owned dairy farm, before you got into collecting, were you thinking about the history of dairy farming all along, or was this something you came to later?
Growing up and working with the cows and farming my whole life, until 5 years ago, I never even thought about it.
And what was it that drew you into collecting historical artifacts from the dairy trade?
Well, in 2013, I had back surgery, so I was laid up for a while. And we've been to antique stores and looking around off and on, and I never really knew what the heck I wanted to collect, if anything. So the first thing I started collecting was milk bottles from Wisconsin. So the first year, year and a half, that's pretty much all I bought in different cities around Wisconsin, was milk bottles. And after that, it kind of, or I couldn't find any more that I didn't have. I had to buy something because it's pretty addicting. So I branched out and bought butter churns and other dairy-related items.
And let's talk about those milk bottles. This was when you had bottlers all over the state, right? And these were these returnable glass bottles.
Yep. I got a bottle that was like one of the first ones made in 1886. And before that, they just scooped it out of one bucket and put the milk in another bucket. Then they came out with these embossed glass. They weren't no color to them in the late 1800s. And they used the embossed bottles until about 1930 to 35. Then they came out with the colored bottles. They were glass, but they were painted. And they used those for about 20 years, and grocery stores took over, where they didn't no longer need milk delivered to the house anymore.
And these all had their own labels saying where they were from and kind of the brand name. Is that right?
Yeah. Yep. On the front and on the back, they usually have some kind of a slogan. Milk is healthy for you, or, you know, some sort of slogan on the back.
And then you branched out, and you've gotten a lot of, you mentioned butter churns, but then you've gotten into different high-tech equipment, high-tech gadgets for, you know, 100, 120 years ago. What kind of things have you found?
Well, just a couple weeks ago, I ran across a fan that stands about 3 foot high. It's got 16-inch brass fans on it, blades, and it turns from the heat of a lantern down at the bottom. It powers the fan. You know, and I'm thinking, I've never seen anything like that before.
Yeah, I never even heard of that.
I haven't either until I've seen it at an auction. Something like that catches my eye. I got some old hand milking machines that I've never seen, I never heard of until, you know, you got into it and start researching. It's just been a lot of fun.
Yeah, I know family members who worked on the farm when electricity first came, and, you know, the electricity went into the barn first before it came into the house. Talk about what dairy farming was like, looking at all this gear, you know, back before electricity changed the game.
Well, basically, all the cows were milked by hand. And most farms only had one or two cows just to feed their family. But then if they got 10 or 12, 20 cows, they still probably milked them by hand until 1910, 1920, where they came out with milking machines that worked fairly decent. But before that time, they had all sorts of inventions a way to milk cows, but I don't think very many of them worked very well until they come out with a vacuum pulsator.
And now let's talk about how you find this stuff. What is your, well, you don't have to share your secrets, but where do you go to try to find old dairy artifacts?
Look at auctions. You know, I get on the computer. I get alerts for auctions within certain miles. Craigslist, eBay. And now that I've been doing it for 5 years, I got people calling, either want to sell me something or even donate it to my museum.
Right, because people, I'm guessing a lot of people around the state could look in the barn or the basement or the garage or whatever, and they've got something that's been sitting there for maybe, what, 80, 100 years?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and some people, you know, the younger generation, the grandkids of grandma's house, they find this stuff and they have no idea what it is.
Yeah, do you help people, do you tell people, you know, hey, here's what this weird thing does that you've had sitting there since before you were born?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of fun of it. You know, I got people come and look at my stuff, and I got a corner. I got probably 25 things hanging on a rack, and I'll pick it up and try to make them guess what it is. And out of the 25 things, nobody can guess one of them.
And you've got it laid out like in a museum. So if we stop by, what would we see?
You will see just about anything from 150 years old to 100 years old, 75 years old, anywhere from advertising signs to toy washing machines for kids to hot dog bun cutters that were made in 1907 in Milwaukee. They used to cut the bun before they baked it.
Is there something out there that you know exists, Ed, that you've been on the hunt for that you haven't managed to bag yet?
There's one milk bottle from Evansville. I think I got 16 or 17. I've seen one milk bottle from another dairy that I have not received yet or been able to find. Other than that, I don't think there's really one thing I'm looking for. You don't know until you see it. You know, one of them things.
But that's one of the things you're still looking for is right in your backyard there, an old Evansville dairy bottle.
Yep. It's a Charlie Moss milk bottle from Evansville. I've seen two of them, and one Charlie's son owns, and the other one, a neighbor lady from where the dairy was, had one. But I don't know what happened to the rest of them. I guess they got buried or broken or thrown away.
Now, you're looking at all this old-style dairy technology. Do you ever think, oh, it would have been fun and great to be a dairy farmer back then before electricity, or are you glad we do things the way we do them now?
Everything that they made back then, they made it to make their life easier. You know, they used to chop up corn by hand. Well, then in 1872, someone invented a hand crank corn chopper that would be a little bit faster than chopping it by hand, but not a whole lot. And how even how they bottled the milk, you know, they used to bottle them one at a time. Well, then they got, or they bottled six at a time. You know, when I got little cream bottles, then I found a blacksmith made a little pan that could fill five bottles at a time. So it'd fill the whole row across the crate.
Well, before we let you,
probably only one of them. I got several things that are one of a kind.
Before we let you go, Ed, are you running out of room or do you still have some space to fill?
Running out of room.
All right.
I got a lot of it displayed in the office of the farm in the basement, but I got some stuff out in the shed that's under a tarp that I don't have room for. And the plan was same day to open up a visitor center on the farm. I don't know when that is going to be, if ever, but that was my goal when I started, just to preserve the history of some of this stuff, because another generation, the younger people, are not going to hear Grandma talking about getting milk delivered to her house. That whole story is going to be gone.
Well, Ed, thanks a lot, and good luck finding that Evansville milk bottle.
All right, thank you.
That's Ed Larson, former general manager of Larson Acres Dairy in Evansville. We talked to him about his big collection of rare and antique dairy artifacts. Many research groups, media organizations, and others lump people together by their generation. So we talk about millennials, Gen Xers, baby boomers, the greatest generation, and so on. And we talk about those generations like they mean something. But our next guest says generational labels don't really tell us much about people, and they conceal more than they explain. John Quiggin is a senior research fellow in economics at the University of Queensland in Australia. He blogs at crookedtimber.org. His recent piece in the New York Times is headlined, Millennial Means Nothing. John, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
Well, in your piece, you talk about the generation game. Can you talk about what you mean by that?
Well, I mean the whole process of trying to ascribe people characteristics based on their generation, and then, of course, in the more harmless versions, write articles on how to market to people of different generations. In more pernicious versions, try and blame the whole of one generation for allegedly bad characteristics. Sometimes, for whatever, the younger generation at the time, they're lazy, entitled, narcissistic, and so forth. That's being said about the millennials now, but it was being said about the baby boomers 50 years ago. Or blaming the boomers for doing all sorts of things to the economy. Of course, that includes, as I mentioned in the article, Donald Trump and maybe a 60-year-old black woman who cleans his hotel for minimum wage. So we're lumping people together in a way that really makes no sense.
Where did this concept of labeling people by generations come from?
Well, I think it really started with the baby boom, which was an actual demographic event. So there really is one cohort starting just after World War II, which was much larger than the preceding one and larger also than the one that followed. So that was an actual demographic event, and the size of that generation had a bunch of big effects. But trying to treat the baby boomers born over a period of 20 years or so as a cohesive group doesn't really make very much sense. The younger ones were a lot of conscripted to the Vietnam War and so forth. But the last baby boomers were still in high school, when they were still in primary school, rather, when the war ended. So we got the baby boomers, and really it's been carried on from there, popularised by people like Strauss and Howe, who put out a book on generations, named the millennials, and really made a little industry out of it.
Well, is there something to it? The Greatest Generation, they had this shared experience of growing up through the Depression and, of course, World War II. Baby boomers, you know, this economic boom they grew up in the United States. Millennials, many of them came out in the workforce as the economy tanked with the Great Recession. Is there something big about historical events like that that does give a common identity to a generation?
Well, it can be in certain cases, but I mean, if you take the baby boomers, it's certainly true that those born before about 1955 came into a booming economy. The subsequent half of the baby boom generation had something very different, and of course, war experiences are very different for men and for women. So, that's one of the most obvious differences that's elided by this stuff. But it's also true that throughout this time, class mattered more than when you came into the labour market. It's certainly true that coming into the labour market in a recession can be have a significant life impact, but nothing like having the right or the wrong parents.
Talking about generational labels, our guest says we put too much faith in them. John Quiggin is with us from the University of Queensland in Australia. And John, let's follow up on that point. You say class matters more than generational label. The wealth and position of your parents makes a bigger difference. Do you think that we overlook those kind of differences when we focus on generational labels?
In fact, I mean, it's often used very, very deliberately, or certainly this is the purpose, to hide those points. So if we look at articles, say, pointing out problems with the boomers and saying that we need to scale back Social Security to bring the budget into balance, that obviously hides the question of what's happened to the distribution of wealth over the last 30 years. And the reason that people are doing badly isn't because one generation collectively has done exceptionally well. It's because the wealthiest 1 or 2% of the current current older generation is doing exceptionally well, and you can expect that on the whole most of their children will do the same.
We heard from a lot of people on Facebook about this already on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tom on Facebook writes that the generational labels are helpful for journalists to write generational think pieces when on a deadline. What do you think of that, John? It's an easy crutch to rely on, even if it doesn't really tell us that much.
Absolutely. I suppose I can only say there's a tiny little industry in writing denunciations of this stuff, which I've been doing for a long time, and you just see it's a very easy, lazy sort of, chin stroker type piece that you can do.
It's kind of fun to talk about, and, around the office, people can bicker between the Gen Xers and baby boomers and millennials and whatever the post-millennials are going to be called. Does it really do that much harm to have these labels out there?
Well, as I say, it certainly, in political discussion, it distracts from the things that really matter. And I think it just leads people, there's a sense in which astrology is basically harmless. you can certainly categorise people in that way. And, of course, to the extent you're tempted to believe it, remember that if you read a reasonably well-written horoscope, any horoscope, it sounds pretty good. It has a bunch of vaguely positive characteristics that you can recognise in yourself. And then if you want to or someone else's horoscope, you can point out the vaguely negative characteristics you see in them.
In your piece, you talk about political differences within what we define as generations, and you talk about millennials and how they vote in American elections. Can you talk about that and maybe more significant labels and divisions that we should be looking at?
Well, yes, if you look at the data, it certainly shows that millennials tend to vote much more Democratic than older cohorts. This is often ascribed to a bunch of particular experiences that millennials have. And, I mean, there's limited truth in that. But the basic fact is that millennials are less, any individual millennial is less likely to be white than somebody aged in their 60s, more likely to be urban, more likely to be educated. All of these are characteristics that are associated with that kind of voting. If you look at rural white millennials without college education. They went pretty strongly for Trump in the last election. So it's really those factors, education, race, and so forth, and class, that really drive the voting behaviour. The millennials collectively look different, but of course that doesn't tell you anything about any individual millennial person.
I want to get back to a point you mentioned earlier, that millennials have been described as lazy and shiftless, but so were Gen Xers and so were baby boomers. Is there just sort of a natural, I don't know, maybe even human motivation to gripe about kids these days and then build maybe our sociological explanation to justify it?
Well, certainly kids these days have been going on forever. And, of course, even the so-called silent generation, when they were doing Black Boy Jungle and things like that in the 50s, of course, we didn't have generational labels then, but they were anything but silent. The early rock and rollers were all silent. So, I think what we see is just cliches about young people. And, of course, it goes the other way. The baby boomers who were once lazy, shiftless, and narcissistic are now rigid and old and tired, just like the people they hoped not to be 50 years ago.
Now, you're watching this. You wrote in your piece about the United States for the most part. Is a similar sort of thing happening where you are in Australia?
Yeah, we Australia has a very similar demographic and economic history to the U.S., and, of course, we're very, very strongly influenced by U.S. trends. So we had pretty much the same baby boom and involved in Vietnam, had very much the same economic conditions. So a derivative version of it, but we have very much the same thing here, with, I suppose, the interesting difference that the housing bubble here has never burst. So there's another theme of discussion here, which is baby boomers have all the housing wealth, which I guess isn't such a big deal in the U.S.
Talking to John Quiggin, he's talking about his New York Times piece called Millennial Means Nothing. He says generational labels, when we talk about millennials, Gen Xers, baby boomers, whatever, it really doesn't tell us much about people. There are a lot more important factors, he says, we should be focusing on instead. John's a senior research fellow in economics at the University of Queensland in Australia, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are there certain ideas about your generation that are out there in the culture that either bug you or you think are actually pretty fair that do describe you and your age cohort? Do you think we overuse these labels, as our guest says, a millennials, Generation X, and think that they actually explain something about people? What do you think about the idea of labeling people by generation? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We're talking to John Quiggin. He's a senior research fellow in economics at the University of Queensland in Australia. We're talking about his recent piece in the New York Times headlined Millennial Means Nothing. He makes the case there that we use these generational labels like millennial or baby boomer a lot, and they don't really tell us much about actual people and the way they behave. There are more important differences that make a lot more difference, he says. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with our guest that we overuse these labels in thinking that they actually describe things? Or do you think there's something to it, that there is something significantly different between millennials and Gen Xers and baby boomers and the silent or greatest generation and so on back to the dawn of time? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. To your calls now, Mike is with us in Janesville. Mike, hi.
Hey, just really quick, I was thinking that we don't challenge our teenagers or give them enough credit either. We don't challenge them enough or give them enough credit. And what I mean by that is, I've never done a study of it, but I wish someone would, about the great things teenagers have done. And I'm talking about, for instance, Thomas Edison, I know, ran a telegraph office at the age of 15. And I don't think we challenge them enough or give them enough responsibility to do that. We coddle, we make things too cushiony, and there's something to be said for responsibility and letting them do that, teaching responsibility from the parent side up. And through history, it'd be interesting to have a study done of ages of back in the day, greatness that was achieved by teenagers.
Mike, thanks for the call. And John, Mike is kind of entering into a common complaint about younger generations that they're coddled. We don't give enough credit. We don't challenge them enough. Is this a common part of the story when people are talking about whatever the current youngest generation is?
Well, it certainly has been for a long time, I think. I mean, of course, the concept of teenagers, I guess, was invented sometime around about the 1950s. Before that, there was that sort of gap wasn't really there, and that reflects things like universal completion of high school. So that was one way in which the experience of turning from a child to an adult has changed, and that has affected the way we talk about younger generations. But there's certainly not much difference in the way guests just spoke about the children post-millennial, I guess, who are teenagers now, and how that was being talked about when my children were teenagers and before that.
Mike, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Anne in Madison. Anne, hi.
Hi. I wanted to read a meme that I saw on Facebook. It says, people born in the 50s have lived 7 decades, 2 centuries, and 2 millenniums. We've had the best music, the fastest cars, drive-in theaters, soda fountains, and we are not even that old yet. We're just that cool.
And thanks for the call. So some baby boomer pride out there. What do you think? I mean, for fun cultural touchstones like that, is it okay to talk about generational differences, John?
Well, they certainly are, although they don't match very well with the demographic generation. So if you look at, say, rock and roll, I mean, most of the people actually made rock and roll were silent, in fact, born before 1945. Just old enough, I guess, to have the first mass audience, which was the younger boomers. So there's certainly, certainly as a boomer myself, I certainly think it was the best music. But I suppose, of course, we didn't have the internet, so there's things change. But those experiences are still very different, as I say, for different groups within the within any given population.
Thanks for that call. John, I wanted to ask, I think a lot of times when I hear people comparing generational differences or talking about generations in the workforce, it seems like they're really focused on middle class, mostly college educated and mostly white members of that generation. Do you think, do you see that when you see people breaking down generational differences?
Yeah, and I mean, it's characteristic, I guess. I think possibly more so in the U.S., than elsewhere, that when people talk about young people, the tiny fraction who attend adult universities seem to get a huge amount of attention. That's and of course, an important point there is you've already eliminated typically most, by definition, class. When you're talking about middle class people, you've stripped out a lot of the racial diversity, and a lot of the time, implicitly the assumption is we're talking about men rather than women.
Talking to John Quiggin from the University of Queensland in Australia, he is making the case that generational labels, millennial, Gen X, baby boomer, whatever, doesn't really explain that much about how people behave. And there are other differences between people that explain a lot more. Back to your calls now. Anissa is with us in Appleton. Hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
Oh, yes. So I am technically a millennial, but a lot of times I don't feel like I fit the realm of the mindset that people, or the negative mindset, I should say, that people have on millennials, assuming that a lot of them, want everything for nothing. I was born in 1986, and I can't quite relate with, millennials that are graduating high school today or maybe starting out in their careers after college, just because I went to high school and we didn't have cell phones. We didn't have social media. And when I graduated college, it was during the recession, so I don't have the, quote, luxury that a lot of millennials, seem to have nowadays, or so what other people say that they do, just because I don't feel like I fit into that realm of a millennial. There's just such a big age difference between myself and, younger adults out there. So I guess that's my point. You can't really relate with all the people in your age bracket.
Anissa, thanks a lot for the call. And she makes an interesting point there, John. Even if we're not talking about, you know, an 18-year generation or whatever length of time we break it up, is there something to be said for studying age cohorts and saying the people who graduated college a couple of years before the Great Recession might have experienced the world differently than the people who graduated from high school or college a couple of years after it?
Yes, there's good evidence that entering the labour market during a recession has a significant impact on your life chances. But, of course, we're not talking about a full-scale generation. And, of course, you need to distinguish between the group entering the labour market after college and the people a few years younger than them who aren't going to college and also entering the labour market with no college, who, of course, have an even more significant disadvantage. So, it's certainly true that those life experiences around early adulthood can make a significant difference. It's more the attempt to erect this into a full-scale classification. And I suppose to bear in mind that a lot of these differences nonetheless wash out by the time people are 30 or are trumped by, as I say, the longer and more enduring things of class and race and gender.
And Anissa also mentioned technological differences. Is it of interest to you to look at, the differences between people who grew up pre and post computers, pre and post internet, common cell phones, that sort of thing?
Well, again, those things are experienced. Yeah, that kind of argument's been made certainly when it was the baby boomers, it was television. And one thing you see is, looking at this literature, is there doesn't seem to be television is a radically different technology from the internet, for example. I mean, they both use screens, but one is a broadcast mass medium and the other one a much more interactive one. And yet a lot of the discussions you see about the impact of those technologies on the generations who came of age when they were new, they seem to be quite similar. And, of course, these days everybody uses the internet. I mean, it's obviously somewhat different never having experienced the period without the internet, but by now I think it's hard for most of us to really remember what that was like.
A weird from Lori on Facebook, who says labels are only used when you're looking for someone to blame, and Linda on Facebook says it's just another way to divide people. So what do you think of what Lori and Linda said? They see these millennial or generational labels being used to create division.
Well, certainly, I think. I mean, obviously, if there are real differences, you have to be aware of those differences. I mean, there's no point in pretending that some of the factors I've mentioned aren't. But I think generational labels really create division where none really exists.
We'll leave it there for now, John. Thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We've been talking to John Quiggin. He's a senior research fellow in economics at the University of Queensland in Australia. He blogs at crookedtimber.org, and he joins us to talk about his recent piece for the New York Times headlined Millennial Means Nothing. He's making the case that generational labels are overused and they underexplain differences from one group of people to another. Still time for you to join the conversation. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page and let us know what you think. Do you see differences between millennials, Gen Xers, baby boomers, significant differences, or do you see more differences within each of those groups? By age, as one of our callers mentioned, by income, by race, by where you live, urban, rural, that sort of thing. Again, share your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page.